Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Dr. Jason Old here, surfer, historian, world traveler, and your host of the Surfing Historian Podcast. This season, we'll be diving deeper into the nuanced world of surfing and examining the historical, cultural, philosophical, and even scientific elements of the sport we're all stoked on. So let's paddle out together and ride through the world of academia. This episode is sponsored by Sovereign Republic. Check out their amazing backpacks at sovereignrepublic.com. I've been personally using their ambassador backpack for all my travels for the last 5 or so years, and it's still as good as new. It's lightweight, stylish, durable, and designed to be carry-on approved for most global airlines. Be sure to use promo code STAYSTOKED for a 15% discount site-wide on their awesome gear. Joining me today is Dr. Stefan Krause. Stefan's the Program Director of Anthropology at Lamar University in Beaumont, Texas. His research focuses on the anthropology of tourism and heritage, and he holds a master's degree from San Diego State University, where he conducted research on surf tourism in Costa Rica. Stefan's anthropology PhD, however, is from the University of South Florida. There, he shifted his attention away from Central America to study the Western Pacific, focusing on the preservation of traditions and customs on the island of Yap in the nation of the Federated States of Micronesia. For today's episode, we'll be chatting mainly about his research in Costa Rica. However, we'll try to make some time for Stefan to fill us all in on all of his other areas of research as well. I'm super stoked to have you on to chat about your intriguing academic endeavors. I learned about Stefan's work while I was conducting research for my PhD dissertation. I was also pleasantly surprised to learn that he's a fellow USF alum as well. But before we get started, I want to personally thank you, Stefan, as well as our listeners, for being part of this episode of The Surfing Historian.
Hey, Jason, thanks for having me. I look forward to this.
Oh, Stefan, of course, man. You know, as I said in the intro, I found out about your research when I was doing my research. And, you know, the other thing I had to throw in the intro was, you know, how we're both alums of USF. So really stoked to get you on. And, you know, I know, as I was saying, my research is Nicaragua, but your stuff really was helpful. Just kind of creating that broader, more regional look at surf tourism. But, you know, today's about you. So I guess as we get started, I'd just like to know what compelled you to do your research on surf tourism in Costa Rica.
As I write about, I have a surfer habitus. So it's like I was sort of driven to go down there for my research. I remember I was at San Diego State at the time getting my master's in anthropology. And so for my master's thesis, I was reading before, I guess, for, you know, as I was doing my master's work and doing my seminars on theory and different things like that. Just, I was starting to process a lot of this theoretical knowledge from anthropologists like Victor Turner and Clifford Geertz and some other sort of pioneers, that really started to make sense. And I started just thinking about my experiences of traveling to Costa Rica a lot, and how much some of their ideas about rites of passage and pilgrimage and sort of the experiential side of travel. And then also looking at it sort of as a global process of, you know, people from the Western world going to developing places and sort of that, you know, post-colonial sort of experience as well. Some of the theoretical things I was going over, it kind of just all kind of came together, and I needed a topic, and I was like, I really want to do this. Cause I had a lot of ideas going through my head about how much it all just made sense. The sort of model of number one, you know, tourism or the surfing subculture for that, for us, it really is sort of like a pilgrimage going to these, you know, quote unquote sacred sites. And at the same time, I also had an applied aspect to it, just kind of looking at, wanting to look at what the impacts of that is, you know, and being part of this subculture, knowing a lot of surfers and seeing how we're different types of tourists than the mass tourists and other categories of tourists you might want to, you know, include in there. Thinking about, you know, is it a good thing or a bad thing for these places we're going? What sort of differences are there between us and those other types of tourists? What kind of economic impacts are we having in relation to other tourists? What kind of, you know, social impacts might tourism, surf tourists, you know, sort of have an impact on in these host countries? And what sort of environmental impacts too? You know, obviously we are generally a lot more environmentally conscious maybe than a lot of other tourists. So there's all these sort of dimensions that kind of came together, and I had the opportunity to go down there. I think I was down there for 2 months in 2006. Basically, I interviewed a bunch of different stakeholders, a lot of traveling surfers, a lot of people in the tourism industry down there, you know, some of the hotel owners, different things like that. And I was able to kind of throw it together. But I think back to the sort of beginning of my answer, just having this surfing habitus, you know, it's if you're part of the surfing subculture, you understand how powerful it can be on just shaping things that you do all the time. And you know, it drew me down there because I wanted to surf too. I can't lie. You know, I wanted to spend 2 months down in Costa Rica. And so, yeah, I think that sort of answers that.
Yeah, it does. You know, and it, you know, it's almost like every episode we sort of make a joke about, you know, all of us as researchers and surfers. And, you know, when we talk to, let's say, non-surfers about our research, you know, many of us make the joke about that eye roll, like, okay, yeah, here you go. You're going to talk about surfing again. Like, we know you just want to go surf. So, you know, I think, you know, you just kind of nailed it there. And many of us have at least acknowledged that, yes, like part of what drives us towards these spaces and where we do our research is also a love for surfing. And, you know, I don't think that's inherently wrong by any stretch, but, you know, I want to bring you back to something you actually say in your research, in your master's thesis. And that's that surf tourism is, I believe you called it an overlooked form of tourism by academics. And so, you know, what do you mean by that? And I guess now that we're in 2023, and I think critical surf studies has grown since you really were on the front lines of this research, you know, in your view, what has changed since you've done this research in terms of surf tourism? Is it still an overlooked form of tourism by academics?
Definitely not as much as it was back then. There were a few sort of sociological, there was Ford and Brown had a book that came out right when I was writing my my thesis or doing my research that in 2006. But as far as other like examinations of tourism, there was backpacking tourism was pretty, you know, adventure tourism, other sort of, you know, even, you know, things like dark tourism, things like that were on, you know, written about. But surf tourism, I don't know why back then or why it hadn't really had a whole lot of attention, at least within anthropology. I can't speak for like, there have been historical, obviously, a lot like other sort of things written in different disciplines. But at least within anthropology, I know it hadn't been really written about too much. But now it seems to have definitely blown up. Even back at my old alma mater, San Diego State, they even have the, you know, I think it's Jess Ponting, if I'm saying his name right. You know, I had never met him, but I was like, wow, after I left, they created a whole department for surf tourism research. So I thought that was really, really cool. But yeah, I to be honest, I kind of switched from my research focus from surf tourism when I did my master's. And then when I got my PhD, when working through my PhD, I actually shifted gears into heritage. So my specialty is tourism and heritage. So they kind of go hand in hand in a lot of ways. But I kind of, you know, focused on my research in Micronesia on cultural heritage preservation and haven't really kept up with all the surf tourism work that's out there. So, but I do know it's a lot bigger now. And just obviously you having this podcast now, and like I said, you know, different sort of institutions having their own focus, like Jess does in San Diego State, I think it's really, really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and yeah, Jess is, you know, all of the scholars there at San Diego State University are doing, you know, really trying, you know, and I had Ed Atkin on, who's also putting together the International Association of Surfing Researchers. So there is a bigger community of us now. And, you know, but hey, you know, I think you said 2006. I mean, it was really new for, I would say, a lot of disciplines, including history. But, you know, in fact, even San Diego State University now is, you know, in their, with their press, like they're trying to publish, you know, surf and skate related scholarly text. And so,
you know what, I was just going back to like the question of why maybe it didn't get the attention. And it kind of reminds me of the story about when I first got into anthropology as an undergrad and studying it. And my professor's asking me, why do you want to be an anthropologist? And I was like, I was honest with him. I was like, I want to go to cool places around the world. I want to study cultures and I like to surf. And as soon as I said I like to surf, this particular professor was like, oh, maybe you shouldn't be an anthropologist.
Yeah.
So exactly. It was like the surfing wasn't taken seriously. And it's like they kind of think of us as maybe all bums or something. It didn't get the, I think maybe that has something to do with the scholarly attention as well.
Yeah.
It's not taken as a serious sort of endeavor and not taken, the subculture isn't taken seriously and stuff like that. So I think as you have more and more people, more and more surfers, you know, becoming established and obviously, and, you know, becoming older in positions in academics and things like that. And I think that sort of kind of led gradually to the demystification or whatever we want to call it.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the other thing is an individual, I think we both have studied, you know, quite extensively because he overlaps particularly our disciplines, anthropology and history, is Michel Foucault. And he was, you know, I would say very much instrumental in a lot of ways, in helping to usher in, I don't know if that's the right word, but helping to bring about what we call in history, the cultural turn. And so I think there's a lot of forces at play, both in my discipline as well as in yours, but it's this new, new approaches to understanding history or anthropology, culture, et cetera, and prioritizing, let's say, culture and how that has an impact in history or, as I say, culture. And so, you know, I think as that became more popularized and people began to focus a lot more on, let's say, culture, surfing being one of them, it also grew. I mean, that's probably a very simplistic way to look at it. But, you know, I think, you know, as you're talking about, I'm thinking to myself, like, yeah, it has grown, but so has the viewing culture through and history through this, you know, viewing surfing through this lens to understand, at least in my case, history. And so, you know, I, by the way, I do want to get into your research in over in the Western Pacific, but, you know, I do want to sort of dig into this research you've done in Costa Rica, because, you know, it was very helpful for me. And so, you know, obviously, thank you. But you say about it, this study builds its argument upon three established yet different areas within anthropological scholarship: subcultural identity and practice, the ritual process, and the varied impacts that large numbers of tourists have in the developing South. So I just want to, you know, can you explain a little bit about, you know, how that helped inform your research on surf tourism?
Sure. Yeah. So that last one, that was sort of the
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save big money at
Menards. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Side aspect of my research, you know, obviously trying to sort of come up with knowledge about what these impacts are and looking at the real world impacts and how and the effects, and then trying to inform or at least putting out there in the world, the, you know, some of this data, so informed, you know, decision makers could have it and things like that. So that applied side of it was important. The more theoretical side. So the first part, the subcultural identity, sort of like we talked about, you know, we're part of the surfing subculture, and it's not homogenous by any means. There's all kinds of different types of surfers that, you know, have their own sort of even more sort of focused subcultures, you know, they're different, but there are a lot of similarities. So when we're talking about surfers, you know, what I sort of saw in Ford and Brown in their sociological, research on this, you also brought up about the habitus and Pierre Bourdieu and this, you know, this great social thinker, and the idea that habitus is, in a way, it's like culture. He kind of was influenced by Max Weber and the idea that, you know, and that Clifford Geertz, another anthropologist, ended up using, that man is an animal suspended in webs of significance that he himself has spun, which is one of my favorite definitions of culture. And Geertz says, I take those webs as being culture. And so in a way, a habitus is like that, because they're the structured structures, that structure, you know, it's kind of, when you read Bourdieu, it's kind of, it's very hard to read off because it's written obviously first in French, but it's very poetic and kind of philosophical at the same time, these structured structures that basically, which is very similar to the web metaphor of culture, is that we have these structures around us that shape us, that we kind of, that shape us into effective, proper members of whatever subculture or culture that we're in, by these norms, these values that we have, and all these sorts of things. But we also can change those structures as well with agency that we have, but it's not very much. So anyways, though, my surfing tourist sort of approach to look, you know, the way I sort of applied that in my research was just thinking of identifying this surfing subculture and identifying all these pervasive traits that kind of inform us, and, you know, and the commonalities that we have, and basically showing how It kind of led into the idea that places like Costa Rica are sacred spaces that help to build cultural capital for us when we go. So, I mean, Bordeaux, a lot of his stuff was about the social fields that we all navigate and understand. So the surfing subculture within that surfing subculture, for instance, you know, we have these this little bit of cultural capital that we always looking out for. We always tell a lot of stories about the places we've been. We always brag about the waves we have. Oh, you should have been there yesterday. All those sort of little actions that we take, you know, in this social field of the surfing subculture give us access to cultural capital within that field. It kind of raises our status within it. So with the game, knowing the rules of the game of how to navigate that social field of being in the surfing subculture, I know I'm not getting too convoluted here, but that was sort of the what I was also identifying with that part of the research. Basically showing this, you know, outlining what the surfing subculture is, you know, the, with the Arjun Appadurai and all the scapes, the media scape of the surfing subculture is so strong in creating these and imprinting on us what it is to be a surfer. And it shaped our shapes our behavior, like all the surfer magazines. Nowadays, it's all changed, obviously, with YouTube and everything else that's out there with social media. But when I was growing up, I mean, I've been surfing since I was seven. And so I remember just always having surfer magazines in front of me and just staring at these waves and just for, and I knew people that were even worse than I was. I mean, you wouldn't find them without a surfer magazine, just kind of constantly. I mean, we would know exactly just by looking at a picture, we know exactly where that wave is. You know, we know who's that just by looking at their board, we know who that surfer is. It's such a pervasive sort of enculturation process that, patterns our habitus, and it creates this, identity that's really strong, and so strong that it compels us to go on these pilgrimages to places that are sacred. And so I talked about how Costa Rica was one of those sacred spaces because, for especially for like Floridians, how cheap it is to go down there. And so all my friends, you know, my surfing friends were going down there, and finally I had a chance to go down there. And then that led into that, I think the second question that, or the second thing that I mentioned, is just not only the subcultural identity, but the experience, the experiential ritualistic side of actually going on a surf trip, which is also, you know, a very, used to be a lot more, not so much today in anthropology, but used to be a focus of anthropology was ritualistic practices and things like this. And Victor Turner was sort of one of the ones that I was really drawn to in his ideas of the rites of passage and these rituals, and looking at how Costa Rica, the whole experience, and it doesn't have to be Costa Rica. If you're, this happens every time we travel. You know, Grayburn talked about this, Nelson Grayburn, another anthropologist at Berkeley. I don't think he's still there, but he kind of wrote the first sort of thing that kind of turned me on to this idea of these trips, you know, surf tourists being, you know, going through these rites of passage on these trips. Every time you go on vacation, you go through a rite of passage in a sense. And the three stages of rites of passage, obviously, separation, liminality, and reincorporation, right? The separation is the stage when you leave your mundane world and you go on this adventure. You basically, you leave the mundane world, that your everyday world, daily life that you deal with, and then you go and step into this transitional stage, number two, the middle period, where that's liminality is. And in that place, it's really magical in a sense. A lot of things, a lot of kind of cool experiential processes are occurring. And so, and then you go through that, all this sort of transformations maybe of this rite of, during this ritual, this liminal ritual of a rite of passage, and then you're transformed back into something else when you're reincorporated into society. Thinking about it in like tribal society is how it worked. You know, obviously they would have cohorts of, you know, maybe young men going through a rite of passage to become an adult. They would all go through this ritualized sort of ceremonial thing, sometimes being sequestered, you know, for days. And it's usually sort of very traumatic and hard, and a lot of tests and, you know, different types of things that would be, you know, very powerful emotionally. And then once they're done, they get reincorporated back into society, now officially as adults, right? And now everybody in their village and would recognize them now as being officially this different person. So anyways, going back to Costa Rica, as you know, number one, it's it's part of that mediascape. And I think I talked about in my thesis about how not only was it very cheap for Floridians and, Californians and Texans maybe to go there, but also you had Witch's Rock on in the summer too. And everybody saw Witch's Rock and was just like, oh my God, you know, just look at that place. And just that became this holy ground that we had to go to. We had to, you know, go on this religious pilgrimage to these places. And so you step out, you know, you thinking about those rites of passage, you leave your mundane world when you get on the plane and you step into a whole foreign, exotic, experientially kind of different world. Anybody that's been on a surf trip for the first time, you probably can just remember what that feeling was like, how exotic and how just like profound it was, right? And everything, the whole world just seems totally alive and different, right? And so in my research and in my thesis, I kind of basically took a lot of the same characteristics that Turner and Van Gennep before him, when he talked about rites of passage, how they sort of defined these different characteristics that are common in all rites of passage. And I took those specific characteristics and I just applied them to surfers and showed, you know, look, you know, all surfers, when they go on, you know, in that liminal stage, some of the characteristics are, you know, status differences disappear pretty much. And so, for instance, when you look at surfers on surf trips, you can't tell who's rich, who's poor. You can't tell who's maybe a, you know, super important back in their home place and who's not. You know, everything, so we're all sort of equal, you know, things like that. All kinds of different, you know, playing around and manipulation of sort of the symbolic aspects of structures, you know, that we dealt with back before. So there, that side of that, the ritualistic side of it was really cool. And I think I'm probably talking too much about it.
It's fascinating. I mean, I'm kind of scribbling down notes because I have so much I want to ask you about it. And I'm just, you know, filling up a page of notes here as you're talking. I mean, it's fascinating. And
I remember just preparing for this. I haven't read that dissertation in years and years, or that thesis in years. And I'm just going through it and I'm like, wow. And I'm a much older academic than you are. So you'll probably get to this eventually when you're reading some of your stuff that you've written a long time ago, haven't touched, and you'd be like, wow, I can't believe I wrote that. And you just kind of get into and it just kind of reinvigorated me. That's why I'm kind of excited to talk about it. I'm like,
wow, absolutely. I mean, even looking back at my dissertation that, you know, I'm like, how did I do that? Like, was I in some trance? Like, how did I pull all that off?
Yeah.
But you know, it's really amazing how you know, and many scholars in our field are taking, you know, sort of these more traditional approaches and then applying it to surfing. And you've applied this sort of concept of the ritual, the rite of passage. You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking of, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was Clifford Geertz who writes on the Balinese cockfighting. I feel like that was you know, the little bit of anthropology I was reading in my history PhD program, I feel like that was one of the ones I read about. And so I'm thinking, as you're talking about all this, I'm reminded of, you know, those readings I did. But, you know, just there's so many great nuggets you just mentioned that I'm going to try to pick apart the best I can. But
Geertz was the one I was just talking about with that definition of the web of, you know, significance, webs of significance, symbolic anthropologist. Deep description, basically look at these ritualistic events, these very important events in a culture, and just look at the symbolic significance of them, how they reflect, basically how these events can be a microcosm of the broader culture, everything that's important in the culture itself. So the Balinese cockfight, obviously, is his example that was super famous, and basically just looking at, just deconstructing the Balinese cockfight and being able to use it to interpret the culture. He kind of led into basically that cultural turn for anthropology. He was one of the ones that led into the post-structural, postmodern sort of movement, you know, basically writing ethnography.
No, I appreciate that. And, you know, I really do feel like a lot of what I did, even for my dissertation or the things I do, will fall under ethnohistory, right? So it's like that gray area between your field and mine. And, you know, and really, you know, I guess for lack of a better term, like the Trinity, right? History, anthropology, political science. Like we really do can all complement one another and learn from one another and borrow approaches and methodology. So know, absolutely. The other thing you brought up was surfer magazines and really, as you know, kind of trying to avoid diving too deep into, you know, Foucault anymore, but, you know, just thinking of the production of knowledge, right? Surfer Magazine produced the knowledge. And, you know, to a point where I would have never imagined in my wildest dreams that for my dissertation research, I'm digging through Surfer magazines as a form of archival research, you know, back in the 90s, when I'm reading a Surfer magazine, I'm doing the same thing you and most everyone else was doing, like, you know, checking out the new styles, the, you know, next greatest surfer, the waves that they're posting, and all that. And so, no, it's great. I mean, there's so much to dig into with that, but, you know, I do, you mentioned this term sacred spaces, right? And I kind of want to, you know, dig a little bit into some of that. And you know, you've mentioned it multiple times. And it was a sub chapter of your thesis on liminality and experiencing the flow of time. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I understand. And maybe if you want to help define it a little better for the listeners as well, but I understand it as, you know, referring to an element of a rite of passage. But would you mind just kind of digging in a little deeper in terms of what you mean here by, liminality and experiencing the flow of time? Because you do say, in a sense, one is plucked out of their mundane life into this sort of tropical escapist style, week or 2 weeks or whatever it may be. So yeah, would you mind just kind of elaborating on that a little bit for nothing else for me? Cause I just find it, you know, very fascinating.
Yeah. I was reading, I was rereading the thesis, and one thing I did sort of notice, like, recently, sort of in the discourse you hear from surfers, watching all the WSL stuff, you know, listening to their announcers talk, and just listening to just various people on YouTube, you know, surfer influencers, if you want to call them, they talk a lot about flow nowadays, right? When I wrote about flow, it wasn't from the sense of surfers. It sort of was generated from some of the work that Turner did back in the 70s, but he wrote on flow and as a, you know, experiential phenomena, psychological phenomena that now we sort of, a lot of especially surfers, can identify with and kind of understand this concept now, because you feel it when you're on the wave, it, you know, this sort of timelessness, you know, you just think about, like, you don't have to apply it to surfing, but just flow, you know, when you're in that flow state, like if you're playing basketball and you just can't miss a shot, and something like that, we all sort of kind of identify and say, oh yeah, that is, I understand what flow is, because I can sense that. But it, the whole liminal period that of the rites of passage, you know, it's, there's so many sort of connections between sort of the experience of being in, you know, as Turner calls it, betwixt and between these two states, these two kind of states of being something before, and then whatever you're going to be eventually transformed into in this rite of passage. But in that middle ground, where anti-structure, you know, all these sort of kind of, they seem sort of almost mystical sort of, you know, concepts, but they're really not, the way you can, if you really kind of break them down. But it just seems like a magical place that is very synonymous to flow. Well, it's really cool. And I know it's almost getting out there a little bit, sort of in the mystical world. And when you just looking at how interesting it is, thinking about the concepts of liminality. Liminality is that threshold sort of space. And it's also physically sort of defined as a door into, like, this new, you know, you're passing through into a new state of existence, in a sense, right? So it's almost this binary sort of, you can think of it also sort of being how, like, the barrier between, like, binary dichotomies, that sort of, you know, whatever is in that little line between whatever, you know, however big or small that line is between two, you know, opposite concepts. And so I talk about in my dissertation, this is just reminding me too, it's like, you know, a beach itself is a liminal period between what conceptually we can call the cultural side of our existence to the natural side of our existence, right? You have actual a barrier between water, sort of symbolizing the natural world and the wild, untamed, you know, wilderness out there. And then you have, you know, the obviously the beach side, on the other side, civilization, sort of, you know, humanity, what we have. So almost sacred, it's almost like a nature nurture sort of dichotomy or whatever. But so just sort of being in that sort of middle ground between, like precisely in like the exact sort of middle of all that, is where this sort of magical kind of flow can happen. And it's, you know, pilgrimages, you know, all during this pilgrimage, if you think about yourself being a religious devotee and going on like on a long, arduous pilgrimage, that entire sort of state of mind, that experiential state you're in, is sort of like a flow experience too. But you're going through a rite of passage from, you know, for them, it's, well, I can't speak for them myself, but oftentimes it's about just sanctifying yourself, you know, cleansing yourself of the sins and coming back, you know, sanctified and you know, and having renewed your faith and things like that. So you're kind of transitioning from one state to the other that way. I know I'm kind of going off on a tangent again.
No, you're good. Just, I mean, it's funny, as you were talking about the liminality and that threshold, you know, I was like, oh, well, you know, I envision the event horizon of a black hole where, like, you know, that that event horizon is where light is just sucked into the hole. And that's probably a horrible analogy, but but as you know, sorry, that's, you know, as you're talking, that's what I was thinking of. But yeah, you know, I appreciate you going into the detail of this, because, you know, you also do write an article that, again, I used, and I'm, you know, grateful for all the work you've been producing that I was able to borrow and help frame out my research, but Pilgrimage to the Playas, I think is the one. And, you know, so you do talk about, you do bring together this concept of the pilgrimage, this sort of sacred voyage or journey. And then, you know, you talk about, you sort of then bring it to the beach and bring it to surfing. You know, and you call, I believe you even titled chapter 5, you know, pardon me if I'm butchering it, but A Secular Pilgrimage to a Sacred Center, right? And so I know you were just kind of talking about, you know, the idea of a pilgrimage, like that spiritual journey, mm-hmm. experience, renewal, if you will. But what do you mean by a sacred center in a sort of secular sense, or that surf space or surf habitus is another word you've been using, but what do you mean by that?
Well, like I said, just because of our subcultural habitus, our, you know, for surfers, Witch's Rock, for instance, we'll just stick with that example, is like a holy spot, you know? So it's in a sense, it's secular, obviously, because it's not really deeply religious, but at the same time, it is deeply significant to us, almost a religious sort of sacred shrine in a way for us. So, so in the same way, you know, Turner calls these sort of things, you know, in the secular world, in the post-industrial world, where we don't have these formal mandated rites of passage and different types of rituals, we see the same sort of types of processes going on in fragmented ways in our daily modern lives. So this would be one of those examples where it's not sacred in the sense that, you know, along the sacred and profane sort of dealing with this, you know, whatever definitions you want to apply to religion and belief systems and things like that. It's not part of the supernatural world, but it's still, for us, it is akin to the same sort of processes that the supernatural world symbolized for, you know, deeply religious cultures. But yeah, so Witch's Rock is this, you know, Mecca in a place, you know, at least I kind of wrote about it being a Mecca for some, you know, and other people nowadays, you can think of all kinds of Meccas, where your favorite wave, if you're a goofy foot, or it might be, you know, Cloudbreaker, it might be, you know, Chopu, you know, Chopu would be a good one, but a lot of people probably wouldn't be able to be a scary one. But yeah, anyways, it's our subculture has sort of, through that media scape, through this just, you know, drooling over all these pictures and videos, especially nowadays videos, all these sorts of things we're watching. We're just like craving, we're watching, and we could feel ourselves on those waves. And, you know, and then eventually the point when you want to take that pilgrimage to go to that place, to have that experience of actually being on that wave. And of course, if you can, to increase your status within the subculture, you want to take videos of it and show all your friends, I was there, you know, and that, so that kind of feeds into the habitus part as well. But yeah, so that's what I was talking about. Costa Rica, symbolizing that sacred space for the surfing subculture, better than most, because it was accessible, because it's, you know, a lot of people had gone there. That, so it's also this place that's, you know, sort of, you know, back then, at least, it's probably changed, but sort of exotic and wilderness like, but also a little bit familiar, safer than other places, you know, sort of how Nicaragua might be getting today is what Costa Rica was, you know, 20 years ago.
That was, you know, kind of a very perfect segue to what I, you know, wanted to mention, and sort of, again, your research and many others helped inform me of this, but just the migration, if you will, of these surfers, Costa Rica to Nicaragua, as you know, in the post, let's call it post Endless Summer 2 world that exposed many of these breaks you're talking, which is rock, and a number of, you know, really put Costa Rica on the map in a very even more significant way. Surfers who were looking for a less crowded experience began gravitating north into Nicaragua. And so, yeah, absolutely. And of course, Witch's Rock is still one of those, you know, you mentioned that place to surfers, and, you know, they know where it is. And much of it had to do with the production of that knowledge through media, through Surfer Magazine, and through these pilgrimages, to use your language. So, you know, along those lines, I know we were kind of joking about us earlier being, you know, scholars, but also surfers. You talk about in this research as well, you note that many hardcore surfers pursue employment that gives them the flexibility to leave work at a short notice or take extended periods off work where they can travel and surf. Kind of sounds like us as professors, by the way. But again, hardcore surfers may decide to move as near as possible to the surf. And so I know we've sort of talked to a bit the idea of we as surf scholars and our desire to be around the waves, right? And so being able to do our research is, you know, it does seem to be a pervasive theme among many of us. But were you thinking of that when you were writing this for your thesis, or were you looking more at other groups of surfers who, you know, that have employment where they, you know, could just say, hey, I'm not going to be here for 2 weeks, you know, waiting tables or whatever employment an individual may have. Is that the demographic of surfer you were thinking about, or what, could you just elaborate a little bit?
Well, I mean, just think, you know, I don't know how many, I'm guessing a good percent.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Of our your listeners or surfers, right? And how many of them, at least when they could, before maybe they had families and things like this, how many of them, you know, had jobs where they could save up a bunch of money and then take a leave for a month or take leave for a couple of weeks and have no problem doing that? You know, all my friends within the surfing subculture, all my close friends, that was sort of what everybody did. And that quote that you just said, I just want to make sure that's not Gordon Brown directly or not, because I know I quoted them and because they in their surfing and
I think you're
theory.
Right. I think you're right. I think it's their quote you used.
That I was quoted. Thank you. Yeah. So yeah. I don't want to take credit for that. But I did notice that with all my friends, you know, that we all sort of had, you know, similar jobs. I mean, I got so many buddies like that will just, where are you? Oh, I'm in Costa Rica, or I'm so-and-so. This, how'd you do that? Well, you know, we arrange our lives to be able to have those kinds of experiences. It's that important to us. And of course, another aspect of this is how privileged we are as, you know, in our society, in the world, to be able to do this too, which kind of gets into another angle of sort of what I was looking at too, just the global processes of, you know, these, you know, white men going around acting like intrepid adventurers, you know, kind of that whole process too is another angle to it, which kind of gets into what we're kind of just came out of talking about too, is like that sacred space, that pilgrimage is typically to places that have these sort of characteristics that are empty waves, that are in the sort of wild, you know, not along obviously coastal cities or anything like that, these exotic countries and these sorts of places. That's what drives us there. Is going on this, you know, endless summer type of adventure, right? An endless summer, all those places they went were these just lonely waves in the middle of nowhere that it took a hard, you know, was hard to get to and, you know, very foreign and exotic and dangers, you know, everywhere, you know, obviously crocodiles in the surf and around Witch's Rock and things like that. So that's part of the attraction that makes it sacred is that exoticness. But another angle, again, to that is, looking at the whole global sort of political economy of it all, about how, you know, what is that, what makes that so attractive for us outside of it being part of the habitus is, what are we trying to escape? You know, if we're going to trying to go into these places that symbolically represent something that typically it's attracted to us because we don't get that same thing back home. So it is a sort of a critique of capitalism in that sense, you know, as far as all the structured sort of pressures we have in the rat race, you know, these places represent sort of a break from that. And that's kind of another, you know, ritual process is going to, you know, the term recreate yourself, you know, recreation is sort of like that in a sense, like we need these sort of time periods throughout our lives to be able to deal with the pressures that we are typically having to face, the structures of the rat race, you know? So, but again, it's another aspect of it too, is how privileged we are to be able to even have these, to afford to go to these places and be in positions where we could leave and all that.
You make a great point. And, you know, Kristen Lawler and I think I was mentioning this earlier, actually, you know, she and I did a really wonderful episode on, her book, you know, The American Surfer, but looking at surfing and capitalism. And we could certainly kind of go with what you're saying and run with it and sort of unpack this, how this, as you said, pilgrimage is can be also analyzed through the lens of a critique of capitalism. Absolutely. I want to, and I find that fascinating, and I enjoyed that conversation, of course, with Kristen as well. I want to kind of dig a little bit more into what you're talking about, though, how that relates to surf tourism, right? That's kind of been the overarching theme. And you're exactly right. You know, and for the listeners, I think it's, you know, I myself am very grateful to have those sort of, as you say, it's a very privileged existence to be able to have those experiences. And I think many listening would agree. I certainly don't want to speak for everybody, but, I do want to dig in a little bit to, what, you know, I myself, Dina, Julia Whitaker, Tara Rutenberg, and Pete Brocious, you know, a number of others refer to as surf settler colonialism. And so viewing this surf tourism, or the expansion of surf tourism into these spaces that you're talking about, these rural coastal spaces, as a form of what, you know, at least I use in my dissertation, surf settler colonialism. And so in what ways in your research, or even just considering Costa Rica now, like in what ways do you see that taking place there?
Well, yeah, I mean, I love that term. I love that. That's a great way to put it. And I think it's quantitative or qualitatively a little bit different than how I sort of articulated the possible outcome of surf tourism. So surf tourism, when I was looking at it, I sort of equated it to backpacking tourism, because there had been some ethnography that was done on how backpackers, you know, kind of go into some areas and then they become all of a sudden they're on the radar of the backpacking community and everybody starts flooding into it. Backpackers start flooding into it. And then after that, they become popular in the more mass tourist sort of space where people see pictures, you know, it's probably different today, obviously, social media and how people are seeing in these different experiences live sometimes, and it's all spreading much differently. But the idea is that, you know, you have these basically pathfinders, I guess you might want to call them, and surfers sort of represent the same sort of type of pathfinder by wanting to go to these exotic places that aren't on the tourist map normally, you know, that they want, because they want to go to a place that doesn't, where there's no other surfers and they don't have to deal with all this. And that whole sort of exoticness of being out in the wilderness is part of the draw. So they go to these new places and then they come back and they tell their friends about it. They show pictures and then you see magazines with pictures, you see them represented in movies, all these sorts of things. And all of a sudden, because surfing has become so commodified and such a big part of, you know, all the fashion, all the sort of things, how much that has blown up in the past 20 years, that surfing lifestyle is now everywhere. And so it's going to spread. These places where surfers go are going to become much more popular and go through that, you know, what Butler called the tourism area life cycle, where they get sort of, found by the surfers. And then eventually people start to go in there, the surf settlers, like maybe you're talking about, but eventually, I guess the argument would be they turn into places that, because they start getting built up too fast and they turn into something then that surfers aren't attracted to. Surfers now, that same sort type of surf tourist doesn't want to go there because now it's crowded, right? Or now it's turned into something less exotic and more mundane. And then you have all this sort of, you know, development that is now by necessity is attracting a different type of tourist, the mass tourists. And then what, you know, typically the places where surfers go, ecologically speaking, probably aren't ready for that type of infrastructure development and all these sort of, you know, numbers of people going to it. So yeah, I think the way that you talk about it in your research in Nicaragua and the way that the surf settler, say the term again, surf settler.
Surf settler colonialism.
Colonialism, okay.
And so like I said, I certainly can't take credit for coining that term. You know, I've borrowed it from others, but yeah, I think it is very indicative of, you know, to sort of go back to Butler, right? Someone you use, Richard Butler. I do think that tourism area life cycle is still relevant and can be used to even, you know, analyze, you know, surf tourism, whether it's Nicaragua or elsewhere, you know, even though I think it was written that he did that in like 1980 or something. But I do think it some would argue it's antiquated, but I you know, I don't know. I find it relevant to be honest with you, but yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But yeah, I think like the example that like you wrote about, you know, the different places, the communities that sort of blew up in Nicaragua that are still there. That to me is not the outcome that he was talking about. You know, that's not the mass tourism Marriott, although in Jaco where I was, there was a Marriott there that did pop up there. So kind of a little bit of both, but it's somehow these places are the surfers that because of their sort of habitus, they didn't want that. So they created a different type of colonial sort of, you know, project for themselves that is not the mass tourism destination, but is still kind of privileged, you know, kind of elite in a way and within their own sort of subcultural sort of social field that provides the super nice houses, all those sort of places where those type of communities. I see one now, or I see sort of parts of that kind of down in Pavones, down in Costa Rica, obviously up around the Nicoya Peninsula and other places in Costa Rica that's happened where you have these enclaves of that are typically started by surfers that know that they don't want to have the big high rises and Marriotts and things like that. So it's a little bit more fine-tuned to the habitus of a surfer. So it's a little bit different. And so how is that then, you know, how is that better or worse than the development that comes along with it? But yeah, so I mean, that is a super important part of looking at the impacts of surf tourism is, you know, what comes along with either that, you know, that colonialism, you know, or the mass tourism, you know, so looking, what I was concerned with my thesis, at least, was looking at things like gentrification. You know, there's all these impacts on the local communities that occur. And you wrote about that too, or at least the conflicts that sort of arose out of, you know, all that stuff that was going on.
Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, I remember back in, I mean, when I was talking to my friends in Costa Rica, the people, my participants, you know, some of the local surfers from Costa Rica, one of them I talked to, he mentioned just how in Jaco, obviously everybody knows where Jaco is. And Jaco, his grandmother like sold like, I don't know how many acres right near the beach for like a couple cows or pigs, you know, back in the 70s or 80s, you know, and then looking at just how, you know, how much that land is going for now, they can't live in these areas. And so obviously that's a huge problem, at least definitely on the economic side, not to mention all the problems that go along with trying to sustain these highly developed coastal areas with very little water available, with all the pollution and no infrastructure and things like that. So, yeah. But I think qualitatively it's different for somehow. I think it's interesting to me what these types of communities like in Nicaragua. I forget the name of the Playa Grande. What's the ones in Nicaragua? The big.
There's a number of you know, developments throughout. And now it's known as the Emerald Coast, but that's the Tola municipality. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned you know, something that's really important. This development model that's taking place on these historically rural peripheries, essentially of say Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and you know, there's a number of scholars, Matthew Taylor, Thomas Levanchi, Sarah Romano, and some others that are doing really wonderful research on water insecurity in Nicaragua in the Gigante Bay area, and then more broadly. But yeah, no, I mean, this is, you know, we have to take the good with the bad when we talk about surf tourism. And one of the things, I'm going to highlight one thing, and then I really want to hear about this, the other research you're doing over in the, you know, the other side of the Pacific, let's say. you know, for me in my research, I think one of the, and a lot of my friends, you know, especially those that are listening to this are going to be, okay, I know, here he goes again. But like, you know, I think the beautiful arc, at least that emerged when I was conducting my research, and it's in my dissertation, really comes to the forefront in my final chapter, which is, okay, so we have these foreigners come in and certainly more affluent Nicaraguans that were part of, you know, that early stage of surf tourism, let's call it. But really, by at this point, the waves are largely dominated by putting aside the tourists, but are largely dominated by local surfers who learn to surf as a result of this surf settler colonial phenomenon, and are now absolutely dominating the lineups. And I think that, at least for me, is a beautiful part of the story. You know, putting aside, you know, some of the other things that you and I and many others critically analyze in our research, but you know, it's really, I get so stoked when I see photos on Instagram or whatever of these kids who were, you know, young kids that someone gave them a board and now they're, you know, blasting big airs and getting super deep in the barrel and just out surfing all the foreigners. And, you know, I think that is, you know, one of the stories that really emerged in my research that, you know, I was like, wow, like almost like I didn't see that coming, you know, and, but it's very noticeable. And anybody listening that's, you know, from Nicaragua is like, yeah, man, you know, like, and they could rattle off all these names of these incredible surfers. But, you know, I do want to, in sort of closing, I'd like to, you know, just personally, and I'm sure that other listeners as well would be stoked to hear about this new research you're doing over, you know, across the Pacific. So, would you mind just kind of sharing a little bit about that? I know you were there for a while too.
Yeah. I lived in, I'm going to try to keep it short because I could talk forever about this as well. But so for my dissertation, I had the opportunity as I was actually preparing, you know, for my my qualifying exam. I got a job in Micronesia working for the Historic Preservation Office, being the anthropologist for the nation of the Federated States of Micronesia. I didn't expect to get it, so I was really super stoked. I had actually taught classes online to students in Micronesia and Samoa right at San Diego State for a few years. And so I'd flown out there and met the students and taught them and things like that. So I had experienced all these cultures. That got me interested in Micronesia, you know, teaching them anthropology and learning about their cultures at the same time. And then having that experience led to being able to apply for this job, which I got. So I had, at the time, before I was going to go out and do that, my whole plan was to do research on service tourism down in Peru, a surfing beach, of course, down in Peru. But then I got the job and I had to change gears just a month or two before I was supposed to be out in Micronesia to do my qualifying exams. And so I had to do all this research. So anyways, I was working for the Historic Preservation Offices and trying to basically help them preserve and protect their traditional culture. And I was a cultural anthropologist. So I went to the state where the capital of the Federated Micronesia is an island called Pohnpei that has a famous site, megalithic site called Nan Madol on it. I doubt anybody's ever heard of it. But I was there for 6 months working with the national office. And because Federated States of Micronesia signed on to what's called the UNESCO Convention for the Safeguarding of Intangible Cultural Heritage, I was shipped to Yap for 2 years. So I lived on this small little island called Yap, which was one of the four states of the Federated States of Micronesia, the westernmost one. And so I was there working in the Historic Preservation Office for a couple of years and also conducting my PhD research, basically looking at what it is from their traditional culture that they want to preserve and protect and what they're losing, what their values are that they're trying to preserve, these sorts of things. Because the way that historic preservation has typically been done is sort of a top-down sort of way of, you know, the experts telling people this is what you need to protect and save, right? And typically, at least in the United States, that model is always about the tangible, the monuments, the buildings, all the, you know, the tangible things. But in the Pacific, obviously, they don't have materials that stick around to have these like pyramids and things like that. So anyway, for them, it's the intangible that was really valuable. So I helped start the UNESCO program there with the intangible cultural heritage. We did workshops to help inventory important things about their traditions and customs that they wanted to preserve. I got really involved and still am really involved with traditional navigation. So, you know, and I get really upset watching things like the Moana how much they basically appropriated a lot of this stuff. And I, just because I get upset about it, because I see how poor my friends are, and there's only a handful of people still alive that know how to do traditional navigation under the stars, right? And these people in Yap were the knowledge holders. They're the ones, Mao Piolong, who was Yapese, basically taught the Hawaiians, retaught the Hawaiians how to do this in the Hokulea, the whole legendary voyage that they had. It sort of reinvigorated these traditions, important traditions for Hawaiians. But now it's disappearing in Yap, and they need support to do it. So to help them preserve it. So I'm kind of lately, I am really kind of focused on the applied sort of help, the projects that I can. I'm putting together I was just there over the summer. So I'm going to put together a GoFundMe to try to help them collect money to be able to rebuild some canoes. Because on the island of Yap right now, they have no canoes in the water, which I was very surprised to learn when I was there over the summer. So the knowledge on how to build these traditional canoes, along with the knowledge on how to sail under the stars without, instruments, just the knowledge that they have and all that, that needs to be saved. And so I'm kind of helping them figure out ways to do that. But trying to expect that help to be coming from institutions like the National Park Service or Historic Preservation Office or even UNESCO. There's so many bureaucratic hoops that I can't wait for that to go that route. So that's why I'm going to try to put together a GoFundMe page to help with that. But that's sort of I guess I just figured out a way to plug it here with you. So I'm glad I did that. But
yeah, that was awesome. Yeah. I was going to ask a little bit more, but there you go. You dropped that plug in there, and hopefully by the time this drops and launches, you're going to be rocking and rolling. So let's kind of, make that plug more official. So by the time this drops somewhere late, in the middle of spring, Stefan, GoFundMe page is going to be up and at 'em.
Yeah. So that'd be great.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. And I do think, given that this is a surf and history podcast sort of at its core, it is important to note that, Hawaii's Polynesian forebears really were exceptional when it comes to, navigation and all of that. And so they, I'm glad you brought that up, and I want to commend you for this research and sort of helping.
Oh, there's so many connections. When you think about like Eddie, what happened, he was on the Hokulea when he died, right? Remember, he basically was trying to save everybody by paddling back. And that whole, he was part of that traditional navigation, society there. And yeah, there's so many connections, and there's waves on Yap too, by the way. Obviously you may have heard of PPAS in Pohnpei surfers.
Yeah.
It's a very famous. Yeah. So that Pohnpei is that first state that I was in, I was telling you about in Micronesia. So there's waves in Yap as well. So I'm trying to encourage tourists to go to Yap because they need all the economic, that's another plug. They need all the economic help they can get.
Yeah. Well, that really brings me to the end of this podcast. And, Stefan, thank you so much, fellow USF alum, super stoked, super grateful for all your research as it helped me, put together what I was working on. But, I'm going to go ahead and give you the last word. You can plug whatever you want. You can say whatever you want, but the last word is all yours, my friend.
All right, cool. Thanks for having me. And thanks. You really sort of reinvigorated my interest in surf tourism research, talking to you over this past, I don't know how long it's been since we first kind of came into contact with each other, but, and what's also interesting too, when I look at, we have our academia, pages and all the citing, all our work, all the research of mine that gets the most coverage or at least visits from people is the surf tourism stuff. So I know that is sort of a really productive area for scholars these days, much more so than my stuff on heritage, but of course that's newer work, but still, and it's making me really want to kind of reinvestigate or maybe do longitudinal studies along the same lines of what I did back 15 years ago. But I mean, I really, and I'm And reading it again, just, you know, you making me sort of read this thesis again is making me really much more interested. And I, as you can tell, I'm talking a lot here about the theories and stuff like that, that we were talking about. So, I mean, I thank you for sort of getting the stoke back in me for at least doing the surf tourism, getting back into that area of research. And I could do both. So, yeah, thanks. And yeah, you got a great thing going here. I wish you all the best with the podcast, and you guys look out for that YouTube link, or not YouTube, GoFundMe link coming when this actually gets published, and help support all my friends out in the app.
If you enjoyed my conversation with Stefan about his intriguing research on cultural heritage and surf tourism, I'd like to invite you to check out my next episode, where I'll be joined by fellow surf historian, Katie Hunt. She and I will be chatting about the history of the surf shop and the early years of California's surf history, from about 1935 to 1959. If these topics pique your interest, then this will certainly be an episode you won't want to miss. We also want to take a moment to thank Sovereign Republic again for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check them out at sovereignrepublic.com. And while you're there, use promo code STAYSTOKED for 15% off your purchase. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Surfing Historian. If you're stoked on these conversations, be sure to share, like, and subscribe to never miss an episode. And don't forget to check out our killer merch at surfinghistorian.com. Proceeds go to help keep this amazing podcast going strong. Until next time, stay stoked.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save big money at
Menards. Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.